Okay, this is the Elizabeth Board of Directors meeting Monday, January 10th, 2022.
Wait.
Business session.
Are we recording? I don't
think
I'm. Oh, sorry.
And I call this meeting to order. Can I get roll call, please?
Yes. Sorry, what time did you say?
Yeah, I said 6:02.
Thank you. Sorry. Happy New Year.
No apology necessary.
Director Blackham?
Here.
Director Booth?
Here.
Director Frumfeller?
Here.
Director Karcher?
Here.
Director Olson?
Here.
All right, thank you. Would you stand and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance? Pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, I'd like, can I get an approval of the agenda? Additions, deletions, blanket motion, please.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
Okay. All right. Any discussion?
Yes. Okay. I'd just like to point out that our Chief Financial Officer is not in attendance this evening. And as was conveyed earlier today to the board, I believe, and that the if I'm able to answer any finance questions, both under communications, we don't have a communications report, so you have a verbal report, so you have the documents that are in the packet. I will try to answer them, but if I can't, I will say so. And then also under the action items, the board should feel free to move forward with them if you feel comfortable, or not move forward.
Okay. All right, roll call, please.
Director Blackham?
Here.
Director Booth?
Roll call?
Here.
Director Frumfeller?
Yes.
That's
Director Karcher?
Aye.
Director Olson?
Yes.
And she did say roll call. That's how it will always be roll call for a motion.
Gotcha.
Okay. Okay.
Right. It's roll call for a tent for present and for every motion where there's an action item.
All right, can I get an approval of the minutes from the BOE meeting December 13th, 2021?
Motion.
Motion.
Second.
Any discussion? All right, roll call, please.
Director Blackham?
Yes.
Director Booth?
Aye.
Director Frumfeller?
Yes.
Director Karcher?
Yes.
Director Olson?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Our communications is up next. And
Jen?
Yep. You are.
Thank you.
You're on.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. So last time I met with you, I talked along with some of the other directors about what we do. So I talked a little bit about what we do in HR. And I wanted to piggyback on that a little bit tonight to kind of give you a little bit of an idea of those things that I talked to you about, kind of a schedule, and what's going to be coming up this spring and this summer. There's a lot going on. I think I mentioned last time that my busy time starts when school ends. And so there's a whole lot of things that are going to be coming up in the spring and the summer, and I just want to kind of put those in a little bit of a context and perspective for you. So starting in the late winter and going into the summer, several things are going to be taking place. We're going to start receiving resignations from staff in probably next month. It's usually starts in February, and those resignations can be anything from retirements to someone who has a different job to someone who's moving out of the area, and that then triggers our recruitment efforts for specific positions that are going to be vacant for next year. So that's going to be starting here in probably this next month, where we'll start hearing from people, getting some formal information from them that they're not going to be back next year. And then that then triggers, like I said, our recruiting for 2022-2023. You might recall that I had mentioned that our turnover for teachers last year was the lowest it's been in probably decades. We're hoping that will happen again. We've done some real good things with our employees this year, particularly some, I think I heard Douglas talking about it earlier, about COVID and leave related to COVID, that I think is a real good thing. And we've done a lot of other good things and hopefully some things to come. So those resignations then will turn into recruitments throughout the summer. And then sometime in March, April timeframe, our employee insurance committee is going to be meeting. That's a real successful, a really good committee, and we'll be looking at our medical, dental, our vision, and our life insurance for next year, working with our broker, and then making a recommendation for our insurance plans for next year. So that's going to be taking place in the spring also. Then we start moving closer into the summer, and we're going to be planning our orientation of our new licensed employees, our teachers, our special service providers that will be coming on next year. The orientation is during the first week of August. It's a full 5 days, and there'll be a lot of training for those people, especially with Marty, IT-related training, and they're also going to have the opportunity to become familiar with their buildings and the people that work in their buildings. So that first week of August is real important, but we actually start planning for it earlier in the summer. We're going to be, any new significant changes to our employee handbook, which is an important document, those are going to be taking place this summer. We'll be then publishing a new employee handbook with any updates that we need. And then, really important item, we have a couple of big ticket items, I guess I would call them. The first one is developing our new pay schedules for next year. That depends on what our revenue is going to be, so that takes a little bit of time until the legislature has finalized their decisions for schools in Colorado. Once they do that, we get into action, and we already have an idea of what we'd like to do depending on what revenue comes in, and then we'll revise those pay schedules, hopefully upward, for our employees, where they can get some increases for next year, and that's a biggie. So, it's a big expense for the district, too, so there's a lot of work that goes in, and generally Ron and I work on those together for our pay schedules. That'll take place in April also. And then as soon as we finalize those schedules, we'll present them to you for your approval, hopefully. And then once we get them approved, then I will immediately, the next day, generate contracts based on those schedules and generate what we call notices of assignment for our classified staff, contracts for our licensed staff. Those will go out that week, assuming that the schedules get approved. And that's a big push because, as I told you last time, we really want to get contracts and notices of assignment out to our employees as soon as possible so they know what to expect for next year. It's, I think, a really good thing for our employees to know what's ahead for them in terms of pay and so forth.
Retention tool.
Yeah, it works. It helps. It helps. So that will take place in April also. And then as the summer progresses, we'll continue to do recruiting, just depending on how many positions we have to fill. Sometimes recruiting goes into the school year. Sometimes we have trouble getting, for example, a special ed teacher. We might have a science teacher, some of the tougher ones to fill. So we don't know how long that'll last, but we'll recruit through the summer and possibly into the school year. Hopefully not. We'll start preparing in the early summer for our luncheon and pinning ceremony that I talked about last time. I hope you all can make it this year. I think you'll enjoy it. It's a big event for us. It's the only time when all of our employees can get together at one time during the year. And then we're getting toward the end here, but in June, we'll be working with our broker for our workers' comp insurance. That's the other big ticket item. Workers' comp is expensive, and we have a really good broker, and they will negotiate on our behalf with Pinnacle, and we'll come to some kind of conclusion in terms of our costs for the next school year in terms of workers' compensation. And then finally, in June, July, the work that our insurance committee did will be presented to our employees, and that will be the open enrollment period when our employees can make changes to their insurances and so forth, and learn about the new plans and so forth. So, a lot going on starting next month, and it starts ratcheting up each month after that. So, and then in August, I'm going to take a vacation.
So.
Okay.
Well deserved.
As long as Douglas approves, I'm going to take a vacation. So. And that's it. Any questions? Yes, sir.
How long is the open enrollment period?
It's parts of 2 months.
Okay.
So we give our employees probably about 5 weeks. I think it's about 5 weeks total.
So June into July.
Into July to learn about our programs, to ask questions, to get any information they need, and then to make their selections.
Okay.
And we do that online. We do the selections online, so it's a nice way of getting all that in. So, yeah.
Okay.
Anything else?
The pinning ceremony, is that still scheduled for August sometime?
Yes, it'll be the first, second week of August. I'll look up the date.
Oh, it is on the calendar?
It should be on the calendar, yeah. It should be the second, I think the Tuesday, that second week of August.
August 9th.
Is that it?
District luncheon.
Yeah. And that's at the high school in the cafetorium. And we're going to have some employees that are retiring that we get to honor. We'll have a nice lunch. We'll recognize new employees. It's fun. It's really fun. So.
Very good.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right. Up next, Marty, technology update.
Evening, everyone.
Hi, Marty.
I only have one thing to update you on, but since Kenna talked about our pinning ceremony and what happens at the beginning of the year, might as well be a good time to kind of let you know in terms of what we do for our new teachers that come in for the new school year. We do a training that it's usually the week before our returning staff come back, and we'll do a training all week, and a lot of that is technology. And generally speaking, I have them for about half a day for 4 days. And so we do everything from distributing their assigned laptops to establishing their accounts to then training on all the different things that they as teachers need and the tools that they need to use. And so we've been lucky to be able to do that the past few years. When I first started working here, we didn't have that available to us. And thanks to the leadership team here, we were able to start that, I forget when. And now we think that a lot of our new employees are well-prepared and get a lot of training to begin the school year to help in kind of that high stress for some of them who might be even starting out as teachers in their first year. But you'll get to hear more about that when we meet, our first meeting in August. By then, we'll have had our teacher training, and usually I give you guys an update on that. So the other thing I wanted to update you on, it's also part of kind of to piggyback on the last time we met and told you what I do and what our department does when I give you a little show and tell, is that we are right now in the midst of going out to bid for our internet service provider. So we were currently on a 5-year agreement with a company called Zayo. And so our 5 years ends this coming summer. This process is part of what I do for E-Rate. If you're not familiar with E-Rate, it's a federal program that was started almost 2 decades ago, I think, that essentially was a way to get funding for schools for broadband connection, for internet connection. And so basically, you would get a discount based on your free reduced school lunch program participation. So a school that's in a socioeconomic impacted area that has 80% of their kids have free reduced or participate in free reduced, those types of schools would get like a 90% discount. We're on the low end in terms of free and reduced. We're usually between 17 and 20%. And so that usually translates still to about a 50 to 60% discount for us for our internet service provider. And so I have to go through this process every time the contract's out to do this, kind of follow the federal guidelines on doing that. And so we're going to go with the same provider that we had before, Zayo. I explained when we first did this 5 years ago that in terms of the internet, back then we had, if you can imagine, if I put it in a way to give a metaphor, we had like a 2-lane highway, like here in Elizabeth. That was our internet. And so 5 years ago, we had upgraded to a 10-lane highway. 2 years ago in 2020, when we started to do our remote learning, we modified our contract to upgrade to a 20-lane highway. So 2 gigs. And so now my goal is to future-proof us, sign another 5-year contract because that's where the savings are, and get us to 5 gigs. So that's like a 50-lane highway.
Can you come out by us?
Yeah. And so that's our plan. And so, what was I going to say about that? And so, actually, because of pricing and because we're a repeat customer and because we're signing a long-term contract, we're actually saving money. We're currently paying, before discounts, we're paying around $2,400 a month for our internet access. That'll go down to about $2,000. And then with our 50% discount, you know, essentially we'll be paying $1,000 a month for our internet. So that's on the horizon. That paperwork and those types of things start now, with a start date of July 1st, and then that July 1st timeline will then start our 5-year agreement, and then I won't have to do this again until 5 years from now. Yeah. Generally speaking, districts go between 2 to 5 years in terms of what agreements that they do. It's up to each district on how they want to. Some districts want the flexibility, so they only do 2 years because they feel like in 2 years they might have to go out again. But I think for us, especially with the cost savings and doubling, more than doubling our current bandwidth, that we should be pretty much future-proof for the next 5 years. So, in terms of internet service, at least, not necessarily all the other pieces and components that go along. Any questions for me?
No? No questions? Thank you, Marty.
Thanks, Marty.
All right. As Douglas mentioned earlier, Ron was not able to make the meeting. And he normally would have discussions about checks over $5,000, and I don't know if the board members had the opportunity, you know, to take a look at that. But are there any questions for Ron that maybe Douglas or I could? What, Douglas?
Well, there would be 2 options: anything that I might be able to answer tonight, or anything that would be for follow up.
So I know there was a discrepancy about the ESSER and how that was covering the HVAC. Is that something you were going to kind of explain? I mean, I think I have a general idea because I think I remember the conversation, but I don't remember the specifics.
Yeah. So I can talk a little bit now, and if I'll be under the action item, because there's an action item asking for board approval to move forward with HVAC replacement project. And there's a large sum involved, 400 plus thousand. Ron would tell you to the penny. Mm-hmm. I just don't have the document in front of me. But I think that one of the questions that came up was the budget shows different amounts, both in terms of revenue from ESSER 3 and for expenditures for HVAC. Like, why, as we consider this approval, why does the budget have numbers that are different?
Okay.
And so I can answer that question.
Okay.
But it may not answer all of your questions. So the budget was adopted in June.
Okay.
The budget is often an estimate or a projection of expected revenues and expected expenses. Easiest example would be we make an informed estimate of the number of students that we expect to enroll, but we don't know. We have the October count, and then that gives us our actual number. We make an estimate in terms of the number of staff and what those staff would be making. But if we know, for example, that we have 5 teacher positions open, we'll make an estimate of the average cost to hire a teacher. But it might be that those teachers' pay is actually less or more than what we estimated. So at this point in the year, and at the next meeting, Ron will present a proposed revision to the budget, which will adjust the revenue based on actual student count. It'll adjust staffing costs based on who we actually hire. And it will adjust ESSER 3 revenue, because at that time, ESSER 3 was relatively, it was in progress. And so both from an expense side and a revenue side, Ron put in estimates.
Okay.
So those will be adjusted based on the most recent information. And they even could be, we could request that the board adjust them in February, March, April, if need be. If, for example, the project is going slower and more of the replacement costs are actually going to be incurred in the next fiscal year to actually move it, you know, to then, etc. So that's why it, when you look at that proposal and the budget, they don't necessarily, you're not going to see 400 plus thousand for HVAC,
mm-hmm.
But a different number.
Okay.
Does that answer?
Absolutely.
That's a significant clarification for the utility. That makes complete sense about, you know, this is 6 months later or longer, and so now we have to make adjustments.
And I mean, just because Ron's absence here was unexpected and just happened this afternoon, he and I didn't have a chance to, in a sense, plan for his absence. So I can make some educated, informed guesses based on having worked together for now going on 13 years, and those of you that live on the board know what we can expect from Ron, but the amount of ESSER 3 going towards the HVAC replacement is basically as large as he feels comfortable with. We have the need. It's a clearly legitimate expense, and it spells it out, HVAC, for air ventilation. It's easier for grants when you have larger items that are clearly authorized, because the record keeping is much simpler, rather than a lot of little things, some of which may be perceived as stretching the definition. So what I believe that number represents is 100% being paid for from ESSER, but I don't know that. If he felt we needed to pull from district funds to pay for some of that, then he could explain that rationale, but I don't have any information that would lead me to think that. The ESSER 3, each ESSER, ESSER 1, 2, and 3, had different requirements. ESSER 3 was the biggest. For us, it was over $1 million. Approximately 17% of that needs to be allocated proportionally to the charter school. The other thing about ESSER 3 is that 20%, at least, a minimum of 20% of that money needs to go to what both the federal government and the state government, but it's driven by the feds, as learning loss. And learning loss, for example, would be the cost of providing summer tutoring for students who've fallen behind. HVAC improves the air quality, which has a lot of benefits for learning, for brain function, for health and safety, but it doesn't directly address academic learning loss. So there are some things in ESSER 3 that you'll see as we continue to develop that proposal that are towards the 20% of learning loss. The remaining 80%, a lot of it will be for infrastructure, because it's one-time money, things that are allowable, like HVAC. So I don't know even if he's prepared to fully break it down, because it's really, it's quite complicated, and they're changing the guidance, and they change what's expected in terms of reporting, and sometimes that will change what we want to spend it on, because, for example, if the reporting burden is too high, we might shift it to reporting burden that's less. Okay.
Good. Thank you very much. Any other questions, finance?
Yeah, on the statements or the checks over 5,000, yeah. I can
From the money that comes from the ESSER fund, you said a percentage of that, 17% of that goes to the charter. Mm-hmm. And so that comes off the top. And yes. then the remaining portion of that, the 20% that has to go to the summer. Yes. Okay. That's all.
I have a question. What's the amount that is something we get every year from ESSER?
It's one-time money. It's a part of a COVID federal government allocation.
Do we know the amount off the top of your head that we got, that we received?
Well, we haven't received it yet.
Oh, okay.
We have to do two things. One is we have to get the plan fully approved. So we've been continuing to provide this. The state acts on the federal government's behalf a lot. So there are a number of federal programs that are administered by the state. So sometimes we might talk about the state, but it's really a federal program, and the state is just implementing the federal rules. So the state, and in this case, the state has some latitude about how to implement ESSER 3. So the rough amount, Heather, is about $1 million. It's the largest of the three ESSERs. They were closer to under half a million. They were, I don't remember their numbers, but significantly less. This is the biggest one, but it's also the most onerous in terms of requirements.
Oh, okay.
And it's my belief, but I don't know 100%, that we don't receive money until we've spent it. Or a lot of the grants are reimbursable. You have to submit evidence of the expenditure, and then they reimburse. But I don't know that for a fact in ESSER 3. But that's why you wouldn't see the money there already. It's not like there was one of the ESSERs, I think it might have been the first one, where they just deposited the money into our accounts. One of the ESSERs. They just gave it. They just put the money in, and then told us how to spend it, and we're following the rules on that. But the others, I think, are more reimbursement as a mechanism.
Okay, thank you.
That's good.
Okay. Other questions on the financial statements or the checks over 5,000?
All right. Very good, Douglas. It's yours again.
Okay. So on to the superintendent report. So let's, just because it's listed here, and I will go more than 10 minutes, but...
No. Just kidding.
The draft calendar. I think that you've been provided a copy of the hot off the presses as of 5 o'clock this afternoon version. It's version C. We have a calendar committee that's comprised of staff from all the buildings and some of the other non-building areas, like the personnel and finance. The committee's met twice so far, and the starting point every year for the calendar is the existing calendar, but not just the calendar itself. There's a lot of accumulated understanding about what works best for our students, for our staff, and for our families. That's a part of the calendar. For example, a question in the past has come up, why don't we start earlier in August? Well, we've surveyed parents, we've surveyed staff, and one of the reasons is that our families really like August for family vacation. Another is that our two elementary schools don't have air conditioning, and August is hot, and the more school we have in August, the greater chance that it's very hot in the schools. So that's one example. So we don't look to start from scratch every year, but what adjustments? So this calendar maintains the things that we've done with two proposed changes, and my my intent tonight is to just inform you of them, but we think that we will be able to present them as a proposed calendar for your vote in 2 weeks. We weren't sure about that when we started our meeting today, but there was some consensus that removed some questions, which I'll explain very briefly. But the two things that are different about this calendar are to make permanent something that we did as a response to dynamics this year, to not have school on the Friday before Christmas break. And that idea for this year came from the Teacher Advisory Council, and it was incredibly well received by all staff, more so than I would have ever imagined. I mean, I imagined that it would be positive, but it affected staff morale every day, almost across the board. I mean, people that are super hard workers and never complain or have any issues of feeling valued or whatever, thank you. Whoever they could say thank you to, they said thank you. They were just so appreciative, and it ended up having a lot of benefit to our staff. We think students certainly appreciated that. And then also, we didn't hear anything negative from parents, so we don't have an exhaustive feedback loop for that from this year, but we didn't hear anything negative. So the proposal was to continue that, that instructionally it's not an important instructional day at the middle school and elementary level. It was a finals day for the high school. They shifted their finals to Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. They only have 4 days of finals. It actually works out better in many regards to do it that way. So the proposal was to continue that. We asked for feedback from the staff on that. They all they supported that. It worked. It worked well. So the idea, though, isn't to save money. The idea isn't to have it be any kind of cost to employees. So what we still have to work out is how would that day impact people's pay? And we're going to put out another survey to staff asking them, would you just rather have that be a day that you don't work and you don't get paid for? Or would you like to have that day moved somewhere else in the schedule and so you work it and you get paid? So it would be giving some choice to the employees as groups, because this impacts every group differently. Custodians often work when we don't have school. They work over the break, unless they request the time off and it's approved. So they value working that day because they like it when there's nobody in the building and they can get stuff done. And they might prefer that day than December 23rd. But they may say, no, well, they're 260 employees. They work the whole year. So it's fun. It's hard not to get too into the weeds, and I don't, because every employee group is impacted differently by this in terms of the number of days they're expected to work over the year.
They're all representative of the committee, right? It's
representative. Not all of them. There aren't custodians. And so what we need to go back out and do is both staff and supervisors, what adjustments would be made to the calendar? Just like it could be that playground aides, they don't care. It could be that bus drivers, they don't care. It could be that, I would expect the teachers to say, no, we don't want to lose a day of our pay, and we work before school, after school, so we would just allocate an expected day for them to work or after, or could float, or something like that. So we have that work to do. Let me stop. There's one other, but if you have questions about that particular change, I could answer them now before getting into the other one. Heather, anything? You guys supportive of that?
I'm very supportive.
I thought it was really good last year that we did that. So
I think it was really good, Douglas, because honestly, and most teachers will tell you, the half day is somewhat of a waste. They're not getting a lot of learning done, especially at like the elementary level. You know, I don't think they're really getting much out of the half day.
Right. Part of our concern was the impact for childcare, but one of the things that we heard back when you guys approved the change was that parents that have a health or a daycare or childcare concern are already addressing it for the afternoon.
Right.
So it's a matter of just extending it.
Right.
Is it grandparents? Is it kids club? What is it? And we really, you know, we hope that it's beneficial for everybody. Students, I think they appreciate it. The staff certainly appreciated it. Our hope was that it would be beneficial to parents, less compressed and more flexibility for either travel or getting ready for the holidays, etc. With this calendar process, we'll have the opportunity to hear from them, because what we'll do is once we have a draft calendar, we will send it to all of our parents and give them the opportunity to give feedback. We won't do a survey. We've only done surveys in the past, like starting earlier in August, when there's a really important change where we need a formal process for getting feedback. But what we do is give them an email address and ask for their feedback, and then we share with the committee and then with you the questions. We typically get the same questions, like, why don't we start earlier in August? Or why can't we have a full week of fall break in October? Or things like that. And then we try to explain that then when the if we aren't able to make, or we don't make that change, the rationale when the calendar is presented for approval and then communicated with parents. So the other one is really the undecided at this point, and that is whether October 13th is a work day for teachers and office staff. It is a non-school day now, has been for a number of years, a non-school day for students, and staff, like bus drivers, kitchen, they don't work that day. Really, the only people that work that day that would be affected would be teachers and office staff. But the potential benefit for teachers would be that they don't have to work that day. If that is not a staff work day, and really importantly, that there aren't parent-teacher conferences that day. That's part of why they work that day. So the impact to the elementary schools for parent-teacher conferences is minimal, because the way that a teacher, if you're a third grade teacher, you look at your schedule and you identify 20 to 30 time slots in your schedule before school, your planning period, at lunch, after school, in a calendar sign up on the computer. The parents of that teacher would then sign up. I want this slot, I want that slot. And they spread out those parent-teacher conferences over a number of days. But the middle and the high school use something that's called arena style, which is everybody at the same time. And before COVID, that the arena was actually an arena. It was either the gym or the cafeteria. It was one place. All of the teachers are there. You walk in as a parent. You see where the shortest line is, and you go there, and you kind of move your way around. With COVID, the schools have changed that a little bit. The middle school has broken it up to 6th grade, 7th grade, and 8th grade. So if you were a 6th grade parent, you went there and all the teachers were there. 7th grade was in a different room, maybe the library or the gym. The high school did their conferences in the classroom. So if you were a parent, you walked in and you found your way around to the classrooms of the teachers. And it just kept from having a lot of people in one space. And that's what we did this fall as well. But it's still the same time. You know, Wednesday from 4 to 8, Thursday from 3:30 to 7:30, or whatever that time is. If teachers didn't work that day, we would need to look at what happened to parent-teacher conferences. Do they do them on Tuesday afternoon, evening, and Wednesday? And that's a big trade-off. Why? Because on Tuesday, that's a 12-hour, an intense 12-hour workday for the teacher. They have their 8 hours. That's not completely, but is filled up with classes. They get a little break, and then they're with parents. And then, if they have any kind of commute, half hour, 40 minutes to get home, have to be here ready to then teach class all day long, and then go another 12-hour day. So it's not... There's trade-offs. So the way that the committee left it is that the principals of the middle and the high school were going to go back to this week and work with their teachers and their office, mostly the teachers, because the office staff, it is a long day, but it's not as demanding as teaching one class after another. It's just emotionally draining. And then, preparing and then being with parents, it's emotionally draining. And so the only people that can really give us feedback would be the people that have to do it, and whether there's a greater benefit for that versus working on Thursday. Right now what they do is they work a 40-hour week in 4 days. They work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then they work Wednesday and Thursday nights. So they don't. It's not a short week. It's just a compressed week. So they really kind of need the three-day weekend to recover. So part of the idea was providing a little bit of break, not just for the students, because the students get a 4-day weekend, so it's good for them. But staff doesn't, the teachers don't really get a good little break there in the middle. And the idea was it's emotionally exhausting to be a teacher. I mean, it's the job. I don't mean to be, poor teachers, but it's something that people that don't teach can find it sometimes hard to understand what it's like to teach every day. It's emotionally draining work, and to allow teachers to kind of be able to recharge a little bit. And so that's one of the things that we're still working out. Once that's settled, a proposed draft calendar will be sent out to parents that would include one of those two options, or it might probably just include, well, I don't know, we have to see where they land, but it could include questions that say, give us feedback on this, and then hopefully we can have a proposed calendar for you in 2 weeks. I don't know, I know I've been giving you a lot of background on that. Have I forgotten anything? I assumed I mentioned it, but we did survey all of the staff. We got their feedback. We not only asked them which calendar they preferred, but why was it best for students, staff, and parents. And we just had a ton of feedback, because it's not just, what's your favorite, but why. And really, another one of the ideas that was discussed was moving spring break a week earlier. And that, at the end, the committee was unanimous. No, that wasn't what was best for students. And part of that was by reading this. And just as to give you one big reason why, we currently align our spring break with the schools in Colorado Springs for athletic reasons. Because that's when most of the districts that we play athletics with, when they have their spring break. If we have different spring breaks, that's 2 weeks where competitions can't be scheduled. Those games need to be made up, which means students can, athletes can have three or four games or competitions a week, which decreases their effectiveness in athletics because they're competing more than they're practicing, but it also means they're out of class more and they are impacted academically, and there's upwards of 100 students that are impacted by that. And that's just that's one of the reasons. And we compete at the middle school level as well with Colorado Springs. So last year we didn't have competitions outside the district. Next year I would expect we would. So yeah, and that's why we do the committee and why we try to ask people for impacts, because you know there's a small group of people that know that. And we try on the committee really to listen to different perspectives to make sure we aren't missing something, including more operational questions that are about payroll or about schedules and that sort of thing.
Do you get the same kind of response from the parents like you get from the teachers?
No. No, unless we do a survey. But when we just say, please give us feedback, we get very little response. Now, with more change, we might get more response. But if they like it, they typically don't respond. If they have something they'd like to see different, typically we get a question. But we do, I would say, if in the past, if we get 10 responses, that's a lot. When it's just, give us feedback. But we like to do it because it gives them the opportunity to ask the question, you know, to respond, for us to... for them to respond to a question about the calendar, and for us to have a greater understanding and acknowledgement that they're okay with it rather than just putting it out there. Most school districts just put it out there. Most school districts don't ask their parents, what do you think of our calendar every year? But we know that our parents generally support it because we ask them every year. And
they might provide really good feedback. That
of course. Exactly. Especially when you make changes like this, we might hear, for example, that Friday is a bigger issue for them than we knew.
Right.
Or they might say, "Oh, this was great. This is better." Right. For you guys to be aware, Legacy Academy for a long time has had school on Friday, so they've been doing it. We thought it would help our families that had kids in both schools, and there's plenty that have kids in both schools. To have a similar schedule.
Douglas?
Hey, Douglas.
Yeah, go ahead, Heather.
I noticed that the other thing that looks like it's a permanent change from last year was the Thanksgiving break. Because I think last year, correct me if I'm wrong, was the first year that you gave the whole week of Thanksgiving off. Is that correct?
We've been the full week of Thanksgiving has been a couple of years.
Has it? Okay.
Yeah. I think that this year was the second year.
Okay.
And there was a lot of work that went into that. Because
I just heard, I heard lots of positive feedback from that. From that change specifically from lots of parents, because they were like, now we can go travel and see family because we have the whole week off. And that was probably the biggest change that as a district you guys have made in the last 10 years. Was one of the best ones I've seen overall, that everybody was so excited over and very appreciative family-wise.
The first one was the COVID year.
I think maybe that's why I don't remember it, because that was kind of a wonky year.
Yeah, so it was the fall after the March when everything went remote.
And right.
It had been approved in January before, and everybody really had the same reaction. It's like, oh, thankfully we have this. This is really beneficial.
That's right. You're right. Now I remember, because everyone also thought, well, maybe they're doing that to give a break where you know, there's everybody's away from the school for a week would be a good thing. You're right. I forgot it was last year.
That was before COVID, and it turned out to be really useful. But I think that independent of COVID, everybody, you know, it's not a negative impact. We've been able to mitigate any kind of negative impact academically, and it does provide a really good time for families, but also a break for kids to then come back and finish the, you know, they're not exhausted finishing out those last 3 weeks before.
Right. Especially high school, you know, where you're dealing with the prepping for finals and all of that. So I just want to make that comment. I've heard nothing but good things about that.
Good.
In 2000, we took the whole week off, and it pushed finals beyond Christmas break, winter break, and it was a disaster. But we've really tightened up our schedule, and to be able to do the week and finish its semester is wonderful. And on that same token, in 2 weeks, could we see where the quarterly and semester break is for the high school on here?
Yeah, the semester break would be before Christmas.
Right.
So it's always there. They don't really use, according to the people on the committee, which includes Brett, they don't really deal with quarters. So they're, you know, it's a running grade.
True.
So they have said that quarters don't matter. The only school that is really using quarters is the middle school, because the elementary is on trimesters.
Right.
So, I think that we currently have the middle school quarters on here, don't we? Yeah. So for October 11th. Because they're the only ones for whom there's an expectation around grades, quarter grades. And what I've been told repeatedly from the high school is they don't, quarters aren't important. It's semesters. Mm. There's semester classes, semester grades, and that the grades are running. So that's why we haven't done it, because that's not important for the students. So.
But, and I'm guessing grades will be completely updated right before parent-teacher conferences, which generally was the quarter for us. So, okay.
Other comments, questions? Are you okay with the direction that we're going?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And the process we're using? Okay. So, thank you. Sorry, I know that probably took 20 minutes, not even 10, right? So that wasn't the only thing that I had, though. Mm-hmm. That was just that one.
So I'll just sit next to Jim. Just say, you may proceed.
Yes. If I was sure that John wasn't listening, not John, Richard, I would say something. But he might be listening, so I'm not going to say anything. Just it. Okay. I wanted to, let's see. Well, I'll do a short thing and then a little bit longer thing. The short thing is that this semester we started the CNA program, the Certified Nurse Assistant. And that's a program that leads to a certificate that is authorized by the state. And the Elizabeth School District, specifically Elizabeth High School, is applying to be able to offer that certificate. It's not an Arapahoe Community College certificate, which are wonderful. but it's a lot of work with the state to meet all of their requirements to be able to offer that. We currently don't have the approval, so we've told students that they may not get the certificate from having taken the course. If they're a senior, maybe it's an opportunity to get the knowledge. If they're a junior, they could take it again and get the certificate. I think we have approximately 10?
Eight.
Enrolled. The modular, so there was a modular that was installed on the north side of the building. That's, it's just a ton of work to get that delivered, installed, equipped, you know, electricity, fire alarms, technology, the beds that they have for the patients, and there's a classroom. There's actually two rooms. One's kind of like a lab. The other's more like a classroom. Hiring the teacher, all that, that's it. And from everything I've heard, it started off great. The teacher is, her name is Carrie.
I'm going to butcher her last name.
Reisinger.
Very excited, very competent, just outstanding to start that program. So it's up and running, and we're, I think it's a big accomplishment. A lot of work by a lot of people, and I know, and we heard from the students, they were excited about that, not because, remember at CASB?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not because they were going to be it, because they knew people who were going to be in it, and it was important for them and their future. So just a prototype of the kind of things that we're in progress with, and the first one kind of out of the chute for more career-oriented learning opportunities. And then the final thing is the thing that seems nobody can have a conversation these days without talking about COVID. So I wanted to talk about COVID because I think it's important to keep you guys apprised of what's happening and what we're doing. So I want to start by sharing some information on the screen that has been an important reference, especially for me, but I would say because I share some of it with staff for us. And I know that it's information that's used by other public officials in the county. Let me see. I just have to figure out, again, how to get it up on the screen here. See, I think you may remember painfully that I could not connect. Marty, is there something that I need to? So I go. Oh, it's not. It's not. Oh, there, there. Good. See, that is. That's. The tech director computers know.
Oh, they do. Oh,
they
know.
Know.
He wants an instant fix.
Yeah.
I have a chip installed like that. That I've conveniently placed in all the computers, so that you think I'm doing something.
You're a walking 40 lane information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, this is the New York Times, and the New York Times has very easily accessible and understandable data on COVID, and they also so they've been doing this throughout the pandemic. There are other sources that are very similar to this, but me, and I know there's others in the Canada, have found this to be really easy to get and quick to get us a picture of what's going on. So I want to almost run through just as quickly as I can what I do on an almost but not daily basis, sometimes daily basis. So this is at the top.
I'm trying to figure out how Heather can...
Oh, yeah, maybe...
Okay, yes. Bear with me, Heather.
I'll wait until we get the camera.
That's not your stomach, really.
Yeah.
Maybe move your chair, too. Right. Do you want me to move the table?
No, I can actually just do this. Oh, but wait, I'm attached to the TV.
Okay. There we go.
Okay. Can you see that okay?
Yeah, right there.
Whoa.
There you go.
Yeah. Right there.
It doesn't like to hold.
She's trying to get it to be stable. It's unstable while it's bouncing around.
Okay.
Right there.
Yeah,
like
down,
she's...
Okay.
It's backwards anyway.
Is that
no,
what it
not
is?
Not for her.
No, no.
Oh.
See, it's good we delayed the meeting for a minute
yeah.
or two to
yeah.
understand.
Okay. I'm walking away. Don't bump it.
Okay, so at the top, this is the United States. And you can see these are the number of reported cases, and I believe that it's all time. So this was the peak in the last winter here at whatever this number is, 200,000, whatever. And you can see what's happened recently. And you, I don't, this is just I'll call it unprecedented, but I don't want to give it any weight. Just what it is, it's a huge increase in number of cases in the country, and a pretty steep incline, because you can see these other increases were not as dramatic, the slope. This is like a straight line, almost going straight up. I'm going to scroll down. These things that you can't read here, each one of these, and it's just a display, is a different state. So just what you can see is that every state is experiencing the same trend, some to different magnitudes. Hold on a second. I was going to try to see. No, it won't do it. To see, like, which state is that?
Right.
But every state is seeing this upward trend. This is the darker the red, the more cases. And so you can see the pattern in the country. But what you can't see clearly there is I can highlight Elbert County. And it'll show the cases per 100,000. So this data is cases per 100,000. So whether it's a highly populated area or a sparsely populated area, it's apples to apples. If you just look at the number there, 121 per 100,000, El Paso County has more. If we go over Douglas County, more, was that more?
Yeah.
Arapahoe County.
Average cases is on the left. That number.
But the cases is going to depend on how many people live in the county.
Right.
So highly populated counties will have a lot more average cases.
Okay. Right.
So like
per
that, they have 1,300.
Yeah.
Let's go down to Elbert.
That was like 32 or something.
Right.
Yeah.
So how do you...
I'm two of those.
How do you understand like how Elbert County is doing? So we saw there, Arapahoe County, 206. We go up one more to Adams County, 200. We move over, it's hard to get Denver. Denver, 180. Jefferson County, 150. So some people would say that Elbert County hasn't been doing so well. I look at this data and I say, Elbert County is doing well relative to our neighbors. And I've been monitoring this, as I said, on an almost daily basis. And I have been saving, not this chart, sometimes this chart, the data. I just have hundreds and hundreds of screenshots as this data has developed over the time.
So this would be the percentage, right, of the number of cases. We have 121 per 100,000. So I don't know what is Elbert County population for.
It's 24,000 or something.
Yeah.
Oh,
do you know? So it's 0.00121%
currently.
Currently, of
yeah.
the number of cases.
Oh, right.
That's nothing.
So
ish.
Yeah. Then I'll take you here in just a minute down to some more data specifically on Elbert County. Now. This is one way to look at it, but there's another way to look at it, which is this. And this is, it shows every state on the left, the number of cases, but that just depends on the size of the state, right? But per 100,000. So now we can begin to compare. And this right now is ranked by cases per 100,000. So we can see how well is Colorado doing relative to other states with regards to cases. And you, when you scroll down, you just can kind of, we could figure out it's number 25 of 50 or whatever, but you can, the further down you have to scroll, the better we're doing. There's Colorado.
Yeah.
Right? How many are below Colorado? Maybe it's in the middle of the pack or a little bit towards under the halfway mark, right? Okay. And Colorado has been in the middle or at the bottom for a lot of the pandemic. There were a few times where it went up earlier a couple months ago where there had been a kind of surge in the south and so forth, and then they had fewer and there were more in this area, Arizona, New Mexico, North, anyway. So then you can also see, well, what's the change? What's the trend look like? And how's Colorado doing there? Colorado, and I know people politically sometimes compare Colorado and California, but California and Colorado have had a lot of similar numbers. And so it's is Colorado up there? Did I miss it?
No,
it's down below.
No, this is the recent trend.
Oh, there it is.
There's 158.6.
Right. So, like, I went to California at the holidays. So, 156 cases, they have more cases. When I went, they had fewer cases, but their growth was much worse.
Yeah, because they grew 405%. We grew
213.
Yeah. It's kind of like, how fast are the cases growing or shrinking?
Right.
Okay. So that's another thing that's kind of, what are the trends? Now, hospitalization and deaths are the two other things that they got here. So I just moved it to hospitalizations per 100,000. How's Colorado doing with regards to hospitalizations? Again, I'm scrolling down to see where Colorado comes up. Wow, you know, I have to keep going down. Wow, right? I mean, the 25 per 100,000 to me only begins to make sense when I look at the other numbers. Is that a lot? Is that a few? I don't know. But it's really towards the bottom of the list. Now, that's just a number. Relative to our capacity with hospitals, that's not on here, and that might put us in either a better or worse situation, right? But I won't do this, but, well, why not? I'm here. The 14-day change.
And this is just for hospitalized?
Hospitalized.
Okay.
So how...
Right there.
Yep. Sorry.
We're up 31%, 25.
Right there.
Yeah, 31%.
So, not quite as slow, but kind of still on maybe 20 out of 50.
We're still in the bottom third, I would say, right?
Yes. So then the other is deaths per 100,000. So again, let's just see where Colorado shows up. If I miss it, there. Okay? I mean, these numbers in and of themselves, it's just relative to other states. It looks like it might be more in the middle of the pack there. Maybe slightly above the middle. It's hard to tell. And then the last one is vaccination rate. And so one of the things that you can even just see right here, that the deaths per 100,000 of the ones that happen to be just a little above Colorado and below Colorado, Colorado has a 67% vaccination rate, and you see a very wide range of vaccination rates in this list relative to more similar rates of death per 100,000, right? You see lows of 49%, of 48%, highs of 67%. That's Guam.
Or Oregon is 67, Guam is 68. Yeah.
Go up a little bit more, there's a 75.
71.
Right, so you see higher per 100,000 death rates in states that have much higher vaccination rates. So, you know, there isn't a one-to-one correlation for these numbers. There's different dynamics in every state. So part of what's been important for me to do is to see what's going on nationally. I read the national press. I read the international press. And then be able to see if there's, like, CDC nationwide policies to understand what's happening across the nation and what's happening with different states. That the other thing then that's useful is you can click on Colorado and see the map for Colorado. And so there have been times where Colorado is not following the nation. So here there was this little dip down. That could be just weekend reporting. It's not clear. When I saw that, I was like, oh my gosh, it's starting down, but it's gone back up again. But in general, it's following the nation. And you can see here the cases and the rate of increase of the cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are still declining. Okay, but hospitalizations, and I've been watching the trend, they've been increasing. They were decreasing a couple weeks ago, they've been increasing. Heather, are you able to follow this?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I can see most of the, I mean, I can't see the exact numbers, but I'm following your little cursor.
Okay. This chart is interesting because it says daily new hospital admissions by age in Colorado. And you can see these ranges here. It's much, the 70 plus has consistently been by far the biggest share. This is the highest under 18.3, because I'll just show you, because I'll go back.
And a comment in there is, this is newly admitted to a hospital with COVID-19 each day, according to data from, it doesn't say because of.
Yeah.
That was going to be my question, right. Is, do they just, are they in there because they got into a car accident and they happen to have COVID?
Yes.
On the news this morning, they said that 45%, it's a report I heard, 45% of the hospitalizations were not admitted because of COVID. They ended up with COVID, but they went in because they're having chemotherapy or surgery or something like that. Yeah.
45% that was?
Yeah.
So here you can see on October 28th, the 70 plus numbers were lower, and so were the under 18. But the hospitalizations for school age children through this whole time period have been relatively low. Okay, each number here, whether it's a hospitalization or a death, at the level of those individuals and their loved ones, and their is huge. So I don't want to dismiss that by any means, but in terms of concern about operating schools in person and the risk of hospitalization or dying, as we move through this, to just give everybody a sense of that.
Douglas, the number that I have been looking at compared to previous years before COVID regarding if hospitalization and death of school-aged children with flu and RSV are significantly worse than compared to COVID.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't been following that data. So, this pandemic has produced a lot of data on things that we never paid attention to before.
That's never knew about it.
So thanks, Heather. This has the map again, where you, like, and I'll look and I'll compare with neighboring counties
to see how we're doing. You can see these numbers just as I visually go through, but they're also represented in a chart by county. So cases per 100,000, and you can see what you may have read in the news. San Juan County, I think, is new to there, but Pitkin, Summit, and Eagle, and Route. Ski resort communities really had just unbelievable case numbers and increases over the holidays from skiing. And then we go down here and we can see, let's see, trying to highlight for you, Heather, the Arapahoe County, 206, Adams, 200, Douglas. These are the same numbers that we saw when I hovered over the map. But now they're in order. And we can look down. We've got Denver, Jefferson County, El Paso County. These are big neighboring Boulder. Where's Elbert?
There.
There's Elbert. Okay, and we could do by the rates. Just because I'm here, I hope this is useful. But you can see that the rates have increased. I'm looking right now for Elbert, so we're right there. Right under El Paso. Now the hospitalization, the average per 100,000. I'm sorry. So it's go ahead, ask the question.
I'm sorry. How is it calculated out per the 100,000 again?
Let's say that there's 10 cases and there's 25,000 people in Elbert County. Per 100,000 would, what did I say? How many cases did I say?
10
times 4. 25 plus 25 plus 25 plus 25,000 equals 100,000.
Right.
So for every 25,000, it would be 40
cases
per 100,000. 40. It's not the, they show the actual number of cases, but you can see there's.
That's based divided into the total population, the total number of cases into the total population. Use that number to get to divide it.
Because the county public health are one of the places that are recording the data.
Why can't they just say that there's 15 cases?
Well, they do. They do, but...
I don't even know per 100,000. I mean, we don't have that many people here.
But how do you know how we're doing relative to Douglas County? And maybe you don't care.
Could they just say they have 80 cases?
But for anybody that's looking at it, a very immediate question is, well, we're a sparsely populated county. Is that good news or bad news? And you could say, oh, well, we have a low number, we're sparsely populated, right? But when you compare apples to apples per 100,000, it's, and you'll see here when I point it out to you, that even within Colorado, that's been doing better than most states on a number of those measures, Elbert County has been doing better than most counties in the state, based on this data. So if we just, and the per 100,000 helps you to see how we're doing.
Creates a need for everybody across the state.
Right, so I think I went down here, there was Elbert here, so we'll just see how many other are below us. It looked like it might be like a little bit above the midpoint in terms of number of cases right now. If we look at the hospitalizations, where is Elbert County? It's a little bit, again, above the halfway point in terms of numbers of counties. The rate of change, I'm not going to do that right now. I'm just trying because there's a little bit more. The deaths per 100,000, how's Elbert County? And this is recent trends. I want to point out that there's two things, all-time and recent trends. So these are recent trends. I think they say that the recent trends is, I don't know how recent it is. It says up there at the top that it's 7 days, but that's a 14-day change. So, again, looking down here, recent for deaths per 100,000. Trying to find, did I pass Elbert County already?
No.
Elbert County. deaths per 100,000, I'm going to try to get to the bottom of the list.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get to that. I think that's the bottom of the list. It's towards, it's under the halfway point.
So okay. You've gone down 21%.
So zero.
Day change.
So recent, it's cases above 50% recently, and then deaths below, and hospitalization maybe in the middle, I can't remember. But if you do all time, it gives a good, like, how we've been faring, and it only has cases and deaths, it doesn't have hospitalization. So this one to me is really interesting. Let's see where Elbert County is on. This is sort of by cases.
For the entire period?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
There, you were on it.
Yep.
Okay, so you can see where Elbert County is relative to the other counties. It's maybe, well, we can count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Of the, I don't know the total number of counties, the bottom 10 in terms of cases. So I don't know if there's any way other than gut and a little bit of data to say, well, maybe citizens of Elbert County aren't testing a lot. So the cases aren't showing up or whatever. I don't know. I know from a school perspective, people are testing. And there is not, any kind of general, pardon?
So they get
the tests. Yeah. Right, so then there was an article in the news, I think within the last 2-3 weeks, that was trying to represent Elbert County as an example of rural counties and not dealing with COVID well because there were a couple of public officials that had died from COVID. Did you see that article?
Yeah.
Have any of you, did you see?
No.
It showed up in Colorado Politics. It showed up in the Gazette. It was a very long article. It had pictures. It was saying basically that there was a problem with Elbert County. There was a problem with the way the rules, and that some of the resistance to the mitigation measures, and here was evidence because you had these public officials, and then some of the numbers and so forth. So deaths through the whole pandemic by county for 100,000. Let me make sure it's sorted properly. And so we start to look and see how has Elbert County fared. There it is. And let's go to the bottom to see how far from the bottom.
15.
Okay. So it's clearly not in the top 50. We could count and we could do the math. But if you begin to look and say, what is, Elbert County representative of? Well, it's very close to Douglas County, right? Douglas County is a little lower, and Boulder are right there. But then let's look up here. We have Broomfield County. We have Denver County. We have Arapahoe County. Jefferson County. El Paso County, Adams County, all with much higher death rates per 100,000. And then the thing is, what about the back? This is the vaccination rate over here. So you have Adams with 63% vaccination rate, Jefferson 72, Arapahoe 66, Denver 73, Broomfield 74.
What's Elbert County?
42. So one of the things in the article was that the low vaccination rate was kind of part of an issue that they were implying was contributing to deaths. And you can see that at the lower vaccination rate, and look right above us, where is this? So, all right, Denver, 73. Elbert, 42. They're death rate per 100,000, 152. Elbert is 116. So what I would like to convey is this kind of starting it from zooming out, not internationally, but just the nation, what's going on. A bit of a sense of there. How's Colorado within that? doing better than most, but not all, right? Not the best, but on all three of those indicators. And then zooming in, how is our community, Elbert County, doing within the context of Colorado? And, you know, when you look at this, there you see a huge range of vaccination rates. Look at these two. Now, these are a small and a large district, but is Elbert County really representative of rural Colorado? It looks more like it's doing better than most of metro Colorado based on this measure of, is it, you know, how many people are in our community are dying from COVID? So, you know, I think that I don't understand what's driving these numbers, meaning why might we have a lower vaccination rate and fewer deaths, especially given the prevailing understanding that vaccination, being vaccinated, helps guard against death, right? That it reduces the number, the chance of dying and the chance of being hospitalized. So you guys could speculate offline privately if you wanted to. I don't really do that. For me, this is important to know, like, how, what's the context that our school district is operating in? What's going on? How are we doing on all these metrics? Some of which don't make sense to me, because a number here, a per 100 death rate of 116 over the course of, I would need some time to really reflect, and what does that number mean? Because it doesn't mean it. I never paid attention to that. None of us have ever paid attention to that. You throw it up there, it's like good news, bad news. I don't know. I mean, it's, you can see the actual number there. It's 31. So 31 people over the course have passed away. You know, if it's a family member of yours, that's huge.
That the Elbert County is 21,000.
She thought maybe 26.
26?
I think it's somewhere between 24 and 26. It's up there.
I think it's it was down there 24. Now I think it's 26. Maybe.
How about 25?
Close to 28.
Oh, okay. 26.
For population-wise, is that what you're saying?
Well, there's one thing this doesn't take into consideration either. It's comorbidities.
Well, it's comorbidities and it's with, not of. These are deaths with COVID, not of COVID. Right, so that's, I'll get back to that. It's 0.00119 for our county.
Well, and I know that some of our elected officials, and I think it might have even been in that article, talked about we have a higher proportion of elderly in our community. Now, I don't know whether that's the case or not, and higher proportion relative to what, the state, El Paso County, I don't know. But if that's true, then this is probably even better news. I wanted to share it with you for two reasons. One, I think it's there's some good news in there. We're not faring worse than average. And we're faring, in some cases, better than average in the state, as a state that's faring generally better than average for the country.
Really supports our case
to continue
providing in-person.
Correct.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what Heather was saying as well, for staying in person. Mm-hmm. So on that point, I want to share something else that this so there was
Marty just looked at the computer. Gone.
Yeah. So I had an invitation. I think it was an invitation to all superintendents in the country, at least that's what it appeared to be, to join a conference call last week, Thursday or Friday, with and they called it a kind of webinar, but it was sort of a second thing, with the Secretary of Education in Washington, in the administration, the Surgeon General. And that was the invitation. In addition to that, a senior White House policy advisor for COVID in schools was on the call, and one of the senior people at the CDC for schools was on the call, and then it was moderated by somebody else from the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. This is a screenshot of the people. So this is Dr. Cardona, the Secretary of Education. This is the White House advisor. Her name is Mary Wall. This is the Surgeon General, Dr. I need my glasses. Dorothy. And then he was introduced as one of the top guys at the CDC for schools. I had trouble finding his exact title and all of that, but he's written a lot. He's been a co-author for a lot of reports, including reports on COVID and that sort of thing. But he was introduced as one of the top guys at the CDC for schools. And I want to play you, not the hour long or even 2 minutes. I want to play you a short 30-second clip from the gentleman from the CDC. And I may have to, like, it's on my phone. I forgot to get some speakers to make sure it was loud. So if you can't hear it, I'll repeat it after I play it once or twice. So he's speaking. The general message from all these individuals was for schools to stay in person. That was the message. Stay in person. The schools are not driving community transmission. Community transmission is showing up in schools. I'm gonna repeat it again here, and I'll stop it because he says two phrases, both of which are things that superintendents in the state of Colorado have been saying to public health for over a year. And public health has resisted. And many regards rejected that, what this individual from the CDC said just last week in front of all of these people and to somewhere between 500 and 1,000 superintendents from around the country. So
just I played again.
Schools are not driving community transmission. Community transmission is spilling into the school space. That's the evidence that we have when we talk about students show up at school with COVID. Right? And we've been sharing with you when we have found evidence of spread within the schools. And we can tell you, and especially Lori and I, last year, the middle school, one or two cases. This year, one situation up at in first grade at Singing Hills, another at the high school in a classroom, where there were, in both cases, two individuals that had COVID and that students spent an extended amount of time, not more than 15 minutes, 3 to 4 hours. We believe we have possibly some spread in the high school this week among people that were working very closely together for an extended amount of time. That I can identify those and that the numbers are so small are clear indicators that the schools are not vectors for transmission, and that when the numbers of students who have COVID are identified, there's somehow the implication that there's a risk because it's spreading in the school. And what superintendents have tried to demonstrate to public health is that schools are safe for kids, and there may be and probably are safer than in the community. And that's not to say the community is a risky place to be. It's hard to know because it depends on the behavior. Really, there's so much spread in the household. So, which is kind of an uncomfortable notion to say, I may be most at risk at home. Why? Because it's a small space, it's enclosed, you don't have outdoor air coming in, and you spend a lot of time together. That's like family life. But the CDC's most recent guidance talks about quarantine and isolation. And they talk about quarantine being especially important for household members. So it's not just us observing this, which we have, and our protocols being a little bit more restrictive if you've had household exposure. Those are the only people that we are asking to stay home. If you've had, and it depends a little bit on the conditions, how much exposure at home. And that's echoed in the CDC guidance that just came out and the CDPHE guidance, that people need to stay home for 5 days if they've been exposed. And so on. Why? Because there's greater possibility of transmission there. Much greater. So for us to say, we're not going to be in person, everybody stay home, it's like, what is that achieving? Because we've got layers of mitigation in place and adult supervision and the ability to provide tests to understand whether or not somebody's positive, to be able to have air ventilation and monitor the quality of the air and so forth. We have a number of things that we're able to do, and we do them consistently, and we track the data, so we track whether there's any evidence of spread. There may have been spread that we did not detect, but both public health and us have put every possible effort into tracking when it's happening. And so going forward, we are going to do everything in our means to stay in person. This week, next week, the following week. The week after that, of course. But we believe that this spike, we don't know, it's going up high and fast. You know, experience in the United Kingdom, experience in South Africa may indicate that it can have an equally fast downward trajectory. But there's debate about that because South Africa's population is younger, whatever. But we think that we are experiencing right now a very intense 2-3-ish week level of sickness and also COVID infection that is going to challenge our operations. It is already challenging our operations. And we have met, we haven't done all of our kind of contingency planning that we need to, but we're in that process, but we've done it at the school level. And what do we do as the number of staff absences increase? How do we keep kids in school? How do we keep them learning? How do we keep them safe? And it is the belief of everybody that's been involved in thinking that through that we can do this and we can do this well. And that is my belief right now, and that's what I want to convey to you. What it might mean is that we have a third grade class that combines with a fourth grade class in the library because we're short a teacher, and that the expectations are not standard because you don't have the substitute teacher that's teaching both of those classes doesn't have the ability to teach third and fourth grade like a licensed teacher who was assigned to do that for the whole year would do. We might combine a math class and a social studies class at the high school, and they're working on some independent work that the teachers have given them under some supervision.
Like a study hall.
And that is better than being at home for the students, academically and socially. To say nothing of the lack of disruption for the families and the parents by having them at home. But what it will look like, we don't know, but we know that it's likely to look at least a little bit, maybe more than a little, but different than normal, but that it's only for a relative short period of time. So, for example, there is an expectation at the middle school that teachers have two graded assignments every week. when we last week asked, can you fill in during your planning time because we have a teacher out? And that's one of the ways that we help when people are out, is existing teachers will take over for their planning period, and then another teacher for the next hour from their planning period. But there was resistance because they have so much work to do in their planning period. It's I have to get these assignments graded. So they looked at adjusting their expectation and say, only one graded assignment per week. So that would be a relaxation of some of the expectations academically. And that's the daily process that the schools are in, is how do we make it through this period, keep learning happening, keep kids in school, keep kids safe, etc. So today, both Kimberly Runyon, the assistant principal, and Brett taught classes at the high school. Today, Jason went over to the transportation building to field phone calls because everybody in the office was out driving buses. The only person there was the mechanic. And if they had a bus issue in routes, the mechanic has to go out, and then there's nobody in the office. He didn't. There were no phone calls, but he was there and provided a sense of relief that, okay, if I'm called out, and for, that everybody knew that. Ron was going to be there, but he couldn't. So I only share that Ron was going to be there to just show you the level of, I mean, he was planning to be there, the CFO, right? But he couldn't because he had to take care of something. And so we had to then find somebody else. And if it wasn't Jason, it might have been Kristen, or it might have been Shelley, or...
could have been one of us.
Yes.
Step up.
Okay, I'm going to put you on speed dial. You know, that's the kind of thing that we're doing. Now, from a bus perspective, I don't know specifically what they're planning, so I want to share with you just a couple of ideas. It could be that we don't have enough bus drivers, and we may need to call the parents on that route and say, we can't do it today. So, two options. One is, you can drive your student to school, or second is, we'll be there 45 minutes late because that bus driver that runs the route will come back and then run that route. Right? That could be the kind of thing. The principals and the schools, if the students showed up 45 minutes late, they can deal with that. That's better than not being in school, and wouldn't be. So I don't know the extent with food service. We may need to serve bag lunches or cold meals rather than hot meals.
I think parents are going to be very lenient on that, Douglas, if shown that, okay, these are where our choices is. We're either doing online school or, you know, we're going to have to move around stuff. I think parents are going to be very okay with that because the best learning for the majority of kids is going to be in-school learning.
Yeah. And I think you're right, Heather, that the parents would support that. That's what we hear last week. Lori talked to a lot of parents because they were calling. We tell them to call her. They do. We were a couple days in Tuesday. She'd already talked or communicated with over 60 people. I don't mean that there were, but that included a little bit of spillover from the holidays. And the feedback, I think, from all but one person was very happy with what we were doing and the approach and the advice she was giving them and so forth. Because at times she tells them things that require some action on their part, some impact on them. You've got to keep your son or daughter home for 5 days. You know, then what do they do? It's not like it's no impact on families when she talks to them. But the other thing that I needed to talk about, it's the last thing related to this, is testing. As you know, that we've been able to provide not an abundant number of tests, but we've been pretty good at being able to provide students and families tests. Sometimes a family is asked for 6 tests. It's because the student may be, and we've given them only to the student. But we've handed out, I don't know the number, I haven't had the time to go back and try to calculate it, but it's somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 tests that at-home rapid tests. So you can think about the number of people that have been impacted by that, right? That's that same number of knowing yes or no, have it, don't have it, multiple testing, etc. We ran out on Friday afternoon.
Yeah, I got the last one.
We ran out. So we ran out of the kits at home. We have some bulk tests, and we're using those for staff, and we're using those. But that's not as convenient as the at-home tests. So staff at school, and the difference with the bulk test is just there's one bottle of the liquid. Whereas the at-home have one bottle for each test, and you can have it, you can hand them out. So we signed up for a program to receive, I don't know the number, 500 to 1,000 tests. And the state had 500,000 tests, the Binax now at-home kits, and they were going to expire in March, and they had approval from Abbott, but they were still good, and they dedicated them to rural schools because of all the challenges of trying to stand up any kind of testing programs in rural schools. We signed up for it. We ordered a whole bunch of tests. We got confirmation on December 13th that we would receive those tests in 3 to 5 days. They've been shipped, and we would receive them in 3 to 5 days. We have not received them. I have been communicating repeatedly with CDPHE, and I don't know. Today, I was told that they were with Amazon, and I should be receiving an email today from Amazon. Thank you. I probably. Let me see. I can do this. Okay, so I'm just going to my email to see, have I heard from Amazon? They said Amazon, because Amazon is doing the delivery. They've contracted with Amazon. News release. Blah, 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 blah. Last chance. No. So I don't have anything from Amazon. They said, if you don't hear from Amazon today, give us a call. I asked them to elevate it. I said, we ran out. Every day this is impacting dozens of families. So we continue to have to improvise almost on a daily basis, based on just how many people need tests, where do we have the tests. We've been doing a lot of moving them around. They've got a lot at Runny Creek. They don't have enough at the middle school. Good, somebody takes them over to the middle school. Let's break open the kit. Instead of giving somebody that needs one, giving them two, break it open, give them the pieces to one so that we can stretch it. I mean, we've had to just get...
Oh, since it's a two-pack.
Yeah, it's a two-pack. If you only need one... Okay,
yeah, exactly.
Break it apart, put in a little Ziploc, give you the one you need. Testing has been an essential part of our protocol this year. It's given families information, staff members information, of course given us information. Right now, we do something that is not required by the CDC. If you have had COVID, after 5 days, if you have no symptoms, you can return. We are asking for people to show a negative test. They advise it, but they don't require it. It's a big kind of brouhaha nationally, you may have seen that. Part of the reason that we do that in part for two reasons. One, we are not requiring masks. We haven't, we're not going to. In place of masks, we have ventilation. It's more universal. We believe it's more effective because it doesn't require, it's not dependent on the quality of the mask or whether it's properly fitted. And we know that most of them are not quality and they're not properly fitted. So how much protection do we really have? We know that it doesn't require the cooperation of anybody to keep the air quality where it is. And we've been, as I said, improving it with additional filters and continued monitoring. So we're not requiring the masks. So we believe that by asking, we don't require it, but a test result. And we've had some that have either been negative and no symptoms, fine. Slight negative. The tests, people have reported, like when you're sick, it's like neon. and it shows up in 5 minutes. You don't have to wait 15 minutes. It shows up quickly, and it's whoop. And they've then tested again. Whoop. Neon. Tested again. Very slow and very faint. So if there's no symptoms and it's slow and very faint, we've been letting them come back. But what we found is that there are people that are still testing positive after day five, and it's not faint. It's like strong. So our assumption is there's still a lot of virus there, and that that could be transmitted. And so that's how we're using it. But we're trying to limit the number of people by category that are excluded from school to if you're sick or if you've had household exposure to get them back as quickly as possible. So we're using the 5 day for both isolation and for quarantine. Isolation if you're sick, quarantine if you've been exposed at home. And then using the test to help get people back, but also to know if they're still infectious, because from what we've seen in all these numbers and in our experience, it is more contagious. More people are getting sick. Not everybody's getting COVID. Kim, do you know the percentage of staff that have been absent today or past?
Yeah, today we had...
You didn't give me that in your email, right?
Yeah, I did.
You did?
Oh, no, not percentage of staff, no.
It's just...
It's around 10%. It's been hovering around 10%.
Of that, today was probably our worst day in terms of filling all the absences. I just learned that there's a term, a measure, you know, like a jargon. Fill rate. The big districts. What's your fill rate? Oh, I know.
Per 100,000.
I've never heard of fill rate, you know. It's like, I don't know, right? So fill rate means how many of your substitutes... Your absences are you able to fill with a substitute. Last week, on Friday, we were at 70%.
Yeah.
Today, we were at 55. That means that 45% of the absences weren't filled through the substitute. What that means is each school or department has to then improvise. So the office staff drive buses. The principals teach, etc.
Mondays are particularly difficult.
Yeah, that's good news, actually.
Yeah.
They are.
Yeah, they are in our industry also.
Yeah. I think that's very common.
Too much.
Sometimes it helps from a school perspective. Because somebody that, like, we had a teacher that came to school today, and I don't know exactly why, maybe just had a little something, but tested and tested positive and then went home, but was fine on Friday. So today was the test day, today was the symptom day. You go back 2 days, they didn't, most likely, they didn't expose anybody at school on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult when it's Tuesday and they were here today. We have to say, oh, who it was in, we used to last year, who was around them. This year, it would only be if there was really like extended close contact. That might happen in some cases for special education, where you have a paraprofessional or a teacher that's working really close with a student throughout the whole day. So you can see why I knew in advance that would be more than 10 minutes, but I hope that this has been useful. Heather, there too. I'm looking at you, but you're on a screen. Oh, you can see me. You moved it.
Now I can see you.
So, I wanted to make sure that you can ask any questions, give me any feedback.
You know, from the get-go, I've been worried back when I was, you know, on a monitor. I was already sensing student achievement was maybe not as great as it could have been during that first go-around. And then the mental health. Of students and staff in particular. And just in the last 2 weeks, talking to people who had COVID, I mean, highly intelligent, functioning people, first, they didn't even know it was depression. And they thought, I guess this is depression. And so I'm hoping that we're staying on top of those two aspects as well as good as we're doing on the front end. what are we doing, and can we have this conversation in the future about student achievement through this period and the mental health of students and staff? Just in the future sometime.
We can, and I can give you a short response right now, especially with regards to academics. You know, the students took the CMAS, mm-hmm. and we and the state came out with both achievement and growth numbers, and Elizabeth Schools did really well in growth relative right. to others. So, through the pandemic, our students have been making progress, and that isn't a big. It's a concern, but it's a concern that both at the leadership level, the teacher level, I think at every level, people are seeing progress. That while we may be spending a lot of time here talking about COVID, not say academics or teaching, in the classroom. That's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They're not talking about COVID. They're not dealing with COVID. They're doing school. And students are engaged. They're not impeded by things like masks in terms of communication and activity, whatever. They're doing extracurricular. They're moving about the school. We heard from the students at CASB the impact for them. They said it's normal. And so I think academically, There may be, but not like we hear in the national press, not we hear in the Colorado press in terms of all this learning loss, etc. There have been some particular challenges with some special education students. There's clearly probably some students who've been impacted because of, like, not general situation, but their situation. Mm-hmm. Our counselors have been spending a lot of time on mental health and supporting students. We have seen more, just like every school district, more assessments that we do, formal assessments for self-harm than kind of the longer term, but that's been and our staff have been responding to those. We have good partnerships with other agencies in the area, which is important. And so we could certainly, for example, ask some of the counselors to come and talk to the board about what they're seeing, what they're doing. You would be, I think, really proud of the work that the counselors are doing, the school leadership, and the teachers. The teachers, I think, are probably, as a group, having the most impact because they're determining kind of the day-to-day life of students in school, knowing their students, asking how they're doing, giving them the support that they need beyond just the academics. And that doesn't mean that there aren't students that are either falling through the cracks or that aren't getting what they need. But I think that that's why our staff are really happy with the approach that we're taking. We backed off on some expectations from staff in order to allow them to adjust and say, these projects, and so HTI has been one, but there's other projects that are going on in the schools to try to balance progress with kind of larger goals and the ability for staff to be able to really kind of adjust what they're doing and what their expectations based on how the students are doing. But I do agree with you that those are both important aspects of what we're doing as a school system. And especially relative to others, I think we're doing as well, if not better.
Like you said, it's not conversation about COVID, it's learning. It's what they're doing. They're schooling, right? The teachers. So, but that's a good question.
And the environment at the schools, it is really good. This just, you can see the kids when they come in, when they leave, at lunch, moving between classes. They're socializing, they're interacting, their life at school it is about as normal as you could expect. And as we heard from the students at CASB, I mean, they feel like they haven't been impacted at all. And it's clearly when a student is at home because they have COVID, but it's not that much different from staying home because you've got the cold or the flu. And students, especially in middle and high school, are used to that. And the teachers aren't really seeing dramatic impacts of having to deal with a lot of absences. I mean, there's some. That's would be wrong to say that there's none. But it's not really dominated like when we were kind of dealing with more remote. So, but we can certainly, I think it would be useful for many reasons to have the counselors come and talk about it just kind of from their perspective. The schools are still doing their testing. Writing is another example of an adjustment. They were doing a school-wide writing assessment at Winnie Creek this week, today. And because they had so many subs, they decided to postpone it another week to not put the pressure on the subs or the teachers who were home. Look, we can do it next week. Now maybe it'll be the same issue and it might get postponed another week, but then at some point they'll do that. We've done math testing do at middle and elementary levels, and we'll, you know, there is less standardized assessment mid-year at the high school, so that's more anecdotal. How do the teachers feel about how the students are progressing? But from everything I've seen, we've all of those things we've more or less kept in place and made only small adjustments. I think our staff have really stepped up. And I know other superintendents, because I've been on calls or meeting with them. Generally, Colorado teachers and schools are really stepping up to the plate. I can't, you know, I don't want to say ours are and others aren't. I want to say that from my understanding, you know, people that are in the teaching education profession, they're stepping up to the plate day after day, continue to adapt. Jefferson County, Adams 12, Boulder, the impact from the fire, you know, assistant principal that lost his home while he was away on vacation, his family, came back, no home, showed up at 7 o'clock Monday morning with a great attitude. I mean, she's one of our lawyers lost her. People were impacted, and they're showing up and just inspiring people with their attitude and so forth. Whether it's related to the fire or not, I can speak very confidently and with a lot of experience about our staff. They just their attitude and their work ethic is just phenomenal, and they're doing it together, which is. I think that's what's helping. Is, you know, nobody's alone. They're helping each other. They're it's a team effort, and it's not a kind of rah rah team. It's like, yeah, I'll give up my plan period, and a lot of collaboration. And it's great. I think that our school district, when it's at its best, is because people are working together and. Just kind of problem solving.
It's refreshing.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Could you hear all that, Heather?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess the microphone's right here, so.
Yeah. Got it loud and clear.
So thanks for dedicating so much time to this, but it is a unique situation that we're in, a unique time, and coming back from the holidays, and just how much the things transformed over the last 4 weeks since we last met. Whatever exactly that was.
That's daily. I mean, it's just evolving daily. But, I'm psyched that we psyched. That's probably not right. That's a good 60s, 70s.
Stoked. Let's sneak out
Are you stoked?
That's an 80.
You know? Yeah, okay. That it's in-person learning.
It's groovy.
And that we're doing everything that we can.
Far out.
Yeah, far out is right. It's
best 70s. You guys are going too far back.
And we are older than
we're
you.
We're dating ourselves.
Yeah. So, all right. Any questions? Any other questions for Douglas? All right, thank you very much, Douglas. All right, can I get, we have no public comment, so I'm going to move right to the consent agenda. Can I get a motion to approve 9.1 through 9.6?
So moved.
Second.
Second.
Any, no discussion on that, it's already done. Roll call, please.
Director Blackham.
Aye.
Director Booth.
Aye.
Director Frumfeller.
Yes.
Director Karcher.
Aye.
Director Olson.
Yes.
All right. Moving on to the action items. We talked a little bit about this earlier. 10.1, can I get a motion to approve HVAC replacement project?
So moved.
Second.
All right. Any discussion? Further discussion? I would just add that I think Douglas did a great job of working through the tough questions on that, so thank you. All right, roll call, please.
Director Blackham.
Aye.
Director Booth.
Yes.
Director Frumfeller.
Yes.
Director Karcher.
Aye.
Director Olson.
Yes.
All right. 10.2, purchase of school buses. Can I get a motion to approve that? Okay.
Second.
Second.
All right. Craig, you second. Any discussion?
When do we know when we're going to get the school buses?
for next school year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't
know. Is it Mark? Is it Mark? Transportation?
Yes, Mark.
Yeah, I happened by there one day, and he gave me the spiel and how we linked in with other schools. He didn't give me the time frame, but he kind of gave me the general timeline.
Yeah. Delivery, like many things, is slow and unpredictable. This is for next school year, if it's earlier. But it takes a little bit of time to get them into service. But, yeah.
Okay. All right.
That's why it's important to do now.
Sure. Last minute.
All right. Any other discussion? Roll call, please.
Director Blackham.
Aye.
Director Booth.
Aye.
Director Frumfeller?
Yes.
Director Karcher?
Aye.
Director Olson?
Yes.
All right, and 10.3, first and final reading of revised policies, AD-school district mission, GBK-staff grievances, GBA, open hiring and equal employment opportunities. Can I have a motion?
So moved.
Okay. Second. All right. Any discussion?
First, I'm going to add that these are, we have established some language around different types of policy changes. There's like substantive, really like, I use graduation requirements as an example when we change graduation. That was a long process. There was, and then there's on the other perspective, just technical changes. And I, these, so
it's just adding kids' contact information to them.
Yeah, so, and that's often when you'll have first and final, it's just technical. It may be something like HINs, or it may be what's just some simple word changes or legal references.
That's always in the package,
yeah.
Very good. All right, any further discussion? All right, roll call, please.
Director Blackham?
Aye.
Director Booth?
Yes.
Director Frumfeller?
Yes.
Director Karcher?
Aye.
Director Olson?
Yes.
All right. Discussion items. I don't believe we have any further discussion items. Our next board meeting is January 24th. Are we all good with that date?
Yes.
Yes.
So I think whether or not you're good with it would be a matter of whether you're going to be there or not.
Okay, that's right.
That's what you meant.
Yeah.
Just to clarify, because they're set by you guys a standard, and it's important to always have those. You can,
it's important to have a quorum.
And, but that's the thing, right?
Right.
It's important to have a quorum and to know whether people are going to miss.
Okay, cool.
And I wanted to say something just about that, that just reiterate that it will be the revised budget, and hopefully Ron's given you all enough kind of prelude to what to expect there, but given that it's the first budget even you haven't even approved a regular budget yet as new members, to feel free that when you get it in your packet to ask questions, if you have questions of Ron, to ask questions here. But because there's so much there, really be important to look at it in advance and to reach out with questions if you have them, and that's fine. That part of what Ron sees as his job right now, it would be to help you understand the budget.
And when do we get that, Douglas?
You'll probably get it Thursday or Friday before the board meeting. Thursday before.
Okay.
It's kind of just, it's, you know, bite off as much as you can chew. And it's a, Kim and Carrie could say, I mean, how long did it take you to feel really comfortable with the budget? A year?
Yeah.
Well, we still ask questions. Yeah. I had questions today, so, I mean, it's still ongoing.
But even to, like okay, I don't, yeah.
Sure.
No, it's different
absolutely.
Enough. It's different enough from normal budgets that, you know, for anybody in the private sector. It's just different. It's a different process, and it really takes some time to learn it.
Right.
I don't know that it should be a year, but because I started as a treasurer, so I really don't understand it. So
it took you 11 months?
Yeah. 11 months, 15 days?
Just say thanks. I was the treasurer a year. Some overachievers.
All right. We're not having an executive session, so it is 8:13, and I adjourn this meeting.